Hi, Eric.
Hello, Mark. How are you?
Very good, very good. I will introduce myself. I'm Mark Schmidt. I'm a senior fellow at the Roosevelt Institute, and this will probably be the third of the kind of regular Blogging Heads episodes that we're doing either with me or with colleagues from Roosevelt. My consul did one last week, so hopefully this will be a good way of engaging people, and we'll get a bunch of interesting conversations going. And I'll let you. Well, I'll just say who you are, and then you can. This is quite what we planned, but I'm here with Eric Liu, who is the author of the new book. This is terrible. This is why I can never be on TV. The Gardens of Democracy. I'm like, all you need to do is remember the name of the book. terrific new book about citizenship. And Eric, you and I.
I'm holding it up too, Mark.
Oh, good. Our paths have kind of crossed. Our paths have. Do you have an institution? What's your institutional affiliation at the moment?
Well, I.
Like two
different organizations. So my co-author of The Gardens of Democracy, Nick Hanauer, and I run a little think tank called the True Patriot Network.
Right.
And that grew out of our prior collaboration called the True Patriot. And then in a related part of my life, I run an organization called the Guiding Lights Network, which is devoted to engage in creative citizenship. And so in both of those organizations, there's a fair amount of overlap. And the book Gardens of Democracy talks both about our role as citizens and the role of government.
Great. Well, even though you're in the other Washington, which is in, you're in Seattle, you have that classic Washington, I always say everybody in Washington needs three titles, or different organizations that they're involved in, and you have that. And our paths have kind of crossed in various ways over the years, right? We were both at New America at about the same time.
That's right.
I think were you on the board of Demos?
I was on the board of Demos. And I'm affiliated with another New America related project, the Center for Social Inclusion, which our friend Gregory Rodriguez is spearheading.
Oh, that's fantastic. Yeah. That's fantastic. Well, that's all great. And I think our paths first crossed when you worked on Capitol Hill right out of college, if I remember correctly.
Wow. Yeah, I think that's right. So right out of college, I worked on the Hill for David Boren, who at the time was a Democrat in the Senate from Oklahoma. And then I worked to work for President Clinton two different stints. I was a speechwriter during his first term and then toward the end of his second term as his deputy domestic policy advisor.
Right. Terrific. Well, you've had a really a very interesting career. And we don't know each other super well, but we have kind of moved along the same. Although I never made it to the White House, and you've written more books than I have. But other than those two big whoppers,
our paths have crossed mainly because I've been reading your writings and been influenced by them for a whole bunch of years.
Okay.
And so I'm glad to do this chat with you.
Yeah, good. Okay. Well, let's start by why don't you just say a little bit about the book, and then I might cut you off because I kind of want to jump in quickly and. Maybe pick some fights because a Blogging Heads isn't a Blogging Heads without some fights. just talk a little bit about what you're trying to achieve with the book, what makes it distinctive. And, I'll say right off the bat, I just got it a day ago and just finished it shortly before we started. So I totally loved it.
Oh, great. Well, thank you, Mark. So The Gardens of Democracy is the second book in a trilogy that Nick Hanauer and I have in mind. And the first, as I mentioned, was a small pamphlet called The True Patriot, arguing in many ways that we need to reframe patriotism, that the idea itself had been co-opted by the right and surrendered by the left to the detriment of both. And in that book, we really tried to lay down a moral framework for understanding what true patriotism should mean, and if you take it seriously beyond mere jingoism and chest thumping, what the content of that ought to be. And in some ways, you could boil down the true patriot to the notion that it's morally wrong to be a selfish sociopath. And in the Gardens of Democracy, we extend the argument to say not only that it's morally wrong, but it's stupid to be a selfish sociopath. The Gardens of Democracy builds on the foundation of the True Patriot to really offer a theory of citizenship and a theory of government that rests atop that kind of values foundation. And what we're trying to argue in this book, the title of the book itself, Mark, comes from a simple metaphorical notion that so much of popular understanding of how the economy works, how government operates, what citizenship means today, derives from a machine metaphor, a machine mindset that we shorthand as machine brain. And in many ways, that metaphor has served us well for a long, long time. But our argument is that today, as we sit here right now, we're in the midst of this several decades old now revolution in the sciences across disciplines that's helping us understand the ways in which the world around us operates not so much like a machine, but like a complex adaptive system, like an ecosystem. And so in our view, the right metaphor to be using for all of these dimensions of civic and public life is the garden, not the machine. And so, for instance, mm-hmm. if you think about the economy, you know, so much of what got us into this crisis, frankly, or at least what blinded us to the paths of this crisis, was a mythology and an ideology that, though it may seem absurd on its surface, has gone virtually unchallenged, that treats the economy like a self-correcting equilibrium machine, and implicitly, you know, a machine that if government should, quote-unquote, regulate it and gum up the works, that's inherently illegitimate. And right. And our view in this book is that, you know, an economy no more self-corrects than a garden self-tends. Economies, right. like gardens, require tending. They require weeding and seeding and feeding. And our view is that when you understand the economy, for instance, not as a machine, but as a complex adaptive system, as a garden requiring gardening, it changes a whole bunch of things about what you think about the role of citizens, the role of government, especially, and how we approach things. And the same is true when you look at civic life and the role of government itself. So this book, The Gardens of Democracy, we're really trying to offer a new lens through which to look at so many of our public policy choices and issues, and right. And really reframe some of the conversation. And you know, I'm a progressive Democrat, so is my co-author. But we take pains to say that when you start looking through this new lens, it does require you to think not so much along a left-right axis, but along something that is a bit more orthogonal to a left-right spectrum. Right. And you know, that's true on a number of different dimensions.
Right. Well, I have to say, I think one of the things, the real strength of the book is really the way you work that metaphor through. And, you know, you and I have both been speechwriters. I mean, we understand, we do understand how, you know, metaphors shape the way you think about things, and the metaphors we use about the economy, in themselves, you know, guide the way that we think about it and guide some of what's possible. But so much of it we do, you know, really casually and unthinkingly, even in those moments when we are engaged in doing something like speech writing, and should be paying real attention to it. So the way the metaphor works through the book is really marvelous. And I often think, a couple times recently, I've just advised people who were writing a book, you know, the way they were describing it, it sounded like the metaphor was going to take over the substance. You know, they would be continually straining to make the metaphor work instead of just writing about what they're writing about. And I think what's great about this book is, you know, the metaphor gets stronger as you go through the book. It really does work, and it allows you to bring in a lot of very unusual level of other resources from, you know, cutting edge thinking about science and social science and economics as well, to really tell the story well. So I think it's really fantastic. I had a little bit, I think there's a little, sometimes just going back to what you just said, at the end, you have a little bit of, to me, a kind of a Tom Friedman problem, or, you know, an Americans Elect problem, or a New America Foundation problem, which is this, the premise of like, okay, what I'm about to say, it's gonna piss people off on the right, and it's gonna piss people off on the left. And, you know, and then what you come out with, to me, sounds like, you know, pretty comfortable for somebody on the, obviously it's gonna piss somebody off who, you know, it doesn't think government should do anything, or is basically a libertarian, or whatever. You know, I'm not seeing, I have one particular issue that I will raise with you, but for the most part, you know, the way you write about economic inequality and its importance actually to growth and issues like that, you know, it seems to me pretty cool with general assumptions on the left.
I think that's,
you know,
I, Yeah, if I can jump in there, Mark, I think on that particular point, I would agree. One of the things that we argue for in the Gardens of Democracy is a new way of thinking about inequality. And so while I would concur with you that our bottom line is very similar to the bottom line of many traditional progressives, namely that inequality is a bad thing, the basis upon which we're making that argument, I think, is a little different from what a lot of progressive left-wing arguments about inequality are often based on. A lot of traditional left arguments about inequality are based on a notion of fairness, that it's just simply unfair that there should be this much concentration of wealth and this staggering level of widening income and wealth inequality. And there's no question that it is unfair on a moral level. But what we're trying to show in this book is that in addition to being to it being unfair and perhaps more compelling to a great majority of Americans, it's simply ineffective. That when you allow this level of inequality to unfold in a country like ours, when you allow a quarter of our national income to concentrate in the hands of 1% of our population, what you get is bad for the whole. It's literally like imagining a quarter of your blood supply clotting up in your big toe. That feels great for the big toe for a little while, but in the end, it kills the body. In the end, it is bad for the body, and the body cannot thrive and succeed. And one of the ways in which one way in which we're differing from traditional progressive arguments, at least in the political realm, probably not among hardcore economists, is making this argument from practicality about inequality. Right. I mean, I think, you know, a lot of the great energy, the resurgent energy that Occupy Wall Street has unleashed in the last few months, and as we sit here now, you know, approaching spring, I predict will unleash again in the coming months, has been mainly proceeding from the moral basis of unfairness. And what we're trying to show here is that you can make, as a progressive, a great argument about inequality being ineffective and stupid for an economy. And moreover, you can make an argument that shows that the nature of an economy, because it's a complex adaptive system that behaves in nonlinear ways, is that left to itself, it will always tend toward great concentrations of wealth. Left to itself, it will always tend toward great inequality, and that the role of government is in part to make sure that that wealth, the lifeblood of the body politic and the body economic, is continuously circulating through the body so that all parts of it can thrive and be healthy. You know, one other note, Mark, I know you want to pick a fight with me on the role of government stuff, and we'll get to that in a second. But in one other note that I think is important, though, where we would differ, I think, more sharply, not just in tactics with progressives, is that while it is true that inequality in our argument is bad, both because it's unfair and because it's stupid, and many on the left will applaud that, we also are of the view that, you know, traditional progressive approaches to government are themselves a little bit stuck in time and in need of great adaptation. And so, again, if you take a complex adaptive systems worldview and understand things as dynamic ecosystems, one of the great pressures that we think government needs to be more amenable to is the pressure of evolution, is the pressure of adaptation. And so much of what we have in national politics right now and the way the federal government operates are legacies of industrial era approaches to how government should operate that preclude a fair amount of adaptation and preclude evolution. And our view is that progressives have to be the one to say, you know what, it's time to loosen up the way that government works because it needs to adapt, and B, as progressives, we're the only ones who have a rooting interest in government succeeding. Conservatives would be perfectly fine to let government ossify and prove itself inept and ineffective and non-adaptive so that they have a better basis upon which to argue shrink it to the size where you can drown it in a bathtub. If as a progressive you believe in theory in government, then you must in practice actually work to reform government and make it far more adaptive than it is today. And that's, again, that's an imperative driven by these pressures of understanding the world as a garden and not as this fixed linear machine.
Right. Well, let's then move to that issue of the government, because I mean I share that commitment. We've got a big project that we're starting at the Roosevelt Institute on the role of government and really, you know, looking at it not just as something that you need to kind of campaign, you need to get people to understand what government does, but actually to be willing to make sure it does those things better. And I think, I mean, I've been interested. I think you published a piece in Democracy a few issues ago that is adapted in some ways into the book, where you talk about the distinction between the what and the how of government. And you call it, well, why don't you take like 30
sure.
seconds to say that
sure.
piece?
Well, part of what we argue in the Gardens of Democracy is that there's a very stale and unsatisfying debate that often goes on in D.C. between those who call for big government or those who call for small government, active government or limited government. And it's on that basis that so many of our political debates are litigated. And our view, the argument in the Gardens of Democracy is that we actually should be having a different kind of argument and a different kind of way of approaching government. And what we call for is not big versus small government. What we call for is government that is big on the what and small on the how.
Right.
Government that sets great, robust goals and ambitions and targets and puts resources behind the execution of those goals, but is far more hands-off and far more agnostic as to the means and as to how you get to those goals. This formula is half satisfying and half unsatisfying to both the left and the right. Right, the left can get on board with the idea of big ambitious goals, whether in healthcare or clean energy or education or what have you, but be mistrustful of the small how kind of hands off notion because it sounds a little too much like Reagan-esque rhetoric of devolution. And conversely, the right can be all on board on what they hear about this notion of small how, because it sounds like decentralization, it sounds like devolution, but they're deeply, profoundly mistrustful of government setting great goals. Our view is that both these things are necessary, again, when you understand things in this evolutionary, complex, adaptive kind of way, that it is wholly appropriate and wholly necessary for a national government like ours, particularly in the context of global competition versus the likes of China, to be very judgmental about some goals. It's not okay just to say, hey, let the chips fall where they may, right? It's wholly appropriate for our government to say the United States should be a world leader in clean energy. The United States
right.
should be a world leader in higher education. The United States should be the world leader in life sciences, right? Not only because
right.
we like to pat ourselves on the back, but because when we lead in those domains, we set in motion all kinds of positive feedback loops of other kinds of intellectual and economic development that flow from that kind of catalytic activity, right? So
right.
it's right to set
right.
great goals there. But as to how we do that, our view is that we need to have far more action that's kind of in the spirit, actually, of something you and I may disagree upon tactically, but we cite as an example President Obama's Race to the Top initiative
right.
In education policy. Right now, for those of your viewers who may not know a ton about it, what they did in Race to the Top was the administration had a pot of money that came out of the stimulus. And they said, instead of simply just, spreading this, an inch deep and a mile wide across all kinds of education programs, we're going to use this pot of money to catalyze innovation in education. And the way we're going to do that is to say, here are a few great goals that we in the Obama administration want to see achieved in education. And you and I and others can quarrel about those goals. They happen to set goals about, higher teacher quality and more charter schools and so on and so forth, teacher evaluation. You can quarrel about that tactically. But what they did was they set those big goals, and then they said to all 50 states, go get it. Figure out a plan that's appropriate to your state. figure out a plan that brings in stakeholders, union, non-union, business leaders, what have you, that works for North Dakota, that works for Louisiana, that works for Delaware or whoever, and then put forth your best plan in a competition, and the states that come up with the most fruitful, interesting, innovative, promising plans to execute on those four big goals, we will fund. Precisely what happened, right? And again, you can argue about the goals. You can say it wasn't implemented, you know, perfectly. But that method, I think, is so interesting and promising, and I think is something that needs to be replicated and experimented upon over and over and over again across the government, in the sciences. Actually, you know, NASA and others have been moving in this direction to try to develop a grand challenges approach, XPRIZE approach. To how you stimulate innovation. And I think the more of that we can get, the better, so that we can capitalize upon and activate the incentive and the wisdom of people out there in a decentralized way.
Right. Well, I mean, I think that there are cases where I'm actually really pretty impressed with Race to the Top, and I'm not, you know, I actually am basically pro charter schools, and I think that, you know, teacher accountability is tough, and we're not quite at the point where the value added models are quite good enough to really do it, but I think it's the right, you know, kind of the right track to go on, and I think that model has been really great. And I think that the record of those kinds of initiatives often shows that. Well, especially in a field like education where, you know, the federal government's not ever, you know, is never going to be the primary provider of resources. So a way of using your, you know, the federal government's 7% of the total in K-12 to, you know, to generate far more than 7% worth of change is a huge innovation. I think that was a great way to do it. In cases where you know that the basic, you know, the basic underpinnings of the resources are there. And it means, I think, that states that, I think, you know, you can see examples of states that didn't get the money, but still actually, you know, the process of going through that plan, and I saw that with a couple of things I did in government too, just the process of going through that plan is transformative. It can be a very effective way of using money if you know that the basic resources are there. I mean, if I put out, you know, the X Prize for, you know, curing cancer or whatever, that's a very appealing model, but the people who are in a position, you know, to get to the point where you can go for that prize, you need, you know, the resources to have a sufficient lab or whatever. One way or another, you know, when you're not on the margins as in education, you need to actually make sure that you're stepping up. I mean, the thing that my reaction to it is not so much that I don't look at it as being like devolution. Because I think devolution is not, you know, I don't really hate devolution if it's real, you know, if it's not just a matter of breaking systems by putting kind of the money here and the responsibility here. Messing. I think a lot of devolution is actually just messing things up. But if you want to say, you know, the unemployment insurance system is a state system, it's going to stay a state system, and the federal government is just back here as a backstop, that's cool with me. So I don't really mind devolution. What bothered me for a while, you know, to me this sounds a little bit more like, the faddish redefining government of the 90s, what's the guy's name? I'm sure
Osborne.
David Osborne.
Yeah.
David Osborne and Ted Gabler in reinventing government. In that era, where their motto was government should steer, not row. And I always got mixed up because of like, is it row not steer, or is it steer not row? You know, you get really confused by it. And of course, if you're actually rowing a rowboat,
big what, small how is easy to remember.
It is easier to remember. But I've been very influenced by Suzanne Mettler's book about the submerged state. And what I take from that book is that we got a little carried away with actually creating government initiatives that were so hands off that people didn't even really know that they were government initiatives, as with all the tax credits that are out there, and things, and so that we're sort of And we're so hands off that we're not actually focusing on whether we're too detached to know whether these things are actually achieving goals or not, as opposed to something like, you know, Social Security is almost the opposite. It's not, there's no national goal. There's just a, here's your system. Money comes in, money goes out. You take the money out. You do whatever you want with it. It's just secure retirement. We're not trying to, you know, the rules are actually super simple. And after that, you're on your own, with how you choose to spend, or how you need really to spend the money. It almost seems like the opposite, but it's a clear cut system without all this kind of nudging and goal setting and incentivizing.
Well, sure, but Social Security is, that is essentially a massive collateralized savings program.
Right.
And so, you know, as a direct transfer of resources that way, it need not be particularly complex, and you know it is one of those things that you know I would agree with you. I mean that works pretty great for what it is, and you know I'm against one size fits all no matter what. So when I'm advocating big what small how as a mindset for reexamining a lot of the things that government does, I'm not saying I want to replace an old orthodoxy with this new orthodoxy, and now everything has to be big what small how. Things like Social Security, you know, are work the way they work. But I think there are there's domain after domain, whether you're talking health policy, housing policy, education policy, where having this approach of big what, small how could be beneficial. And, you know, your point, Mark, is absolutely right that a lot of the quote-unquote devolution that we've seen over the last couple of decades, or at least since Reagan began to talk about this more, has been fake devolution. You know, it's and in a way, what we're calling for in the Gardens of Democracy is not the unfunded mandates that a lot of people complain about when they get this kind of fake devolution. What we're calling for is funded mandates. Set goals, put resources behind them,
This is what I don't really understand, because resources are a how. You know, if you say, you know, any kind of goal, take a particular goal in education, you say we're going to do, you know, we're going to make you get all eighth graders to proficiency in reading, and we're going to put resources behind it. How is that not big what, big how?
Well, because it is a resource is not a how. How a dollar is spent, you know, a dollar is agnostic as to whether it's spent on charter schools or spent on a non-charter school, right? A dollar is agnostic as to whether it is spent to catalyze better principal training programs or just pour money into the same old system, right? In both cases, there's no question our education system could benefit from more dollars, whichever way you spend them, right? But the dollars themselves are agnostic, right? I think, this is your point earlier about the submerged state. I want to return to as well, because I think that is important. And when you get to, I live in Seattle, and I think a lot about these questions of government, not only at the national abstract level, but just seeing how they impact a city like Seattle, which is very much a city of neighborhoods. It's a city in which kind of civic identity is rooted in local place. And I think one of the things when you start talking about government's role, an approach to government that is big on the what and small on the how, the necessary, indispensable corollary to that, Mark, is that we need bigger citizenship, is that citizens and neighbors have to step in and be more engaged and not subcontract this out to say, oh, well, there's some foster care program that's going on, you know, five blocks away from me, and it's government funded, and I don't really know what's going on with it, and, you know, it's not my deal. But to recognize that if it's five blocks away from you, it is your deal. And if the young people, you know, in kinship care or foster care who live around your neighborhood are part of your neighborhood, then it behooves us all to figure out how do we in ways seen and unseen, stitch together a stronger sense of community and citizenship to support whatever the approach the government might be taking. And I think this is an approach to citizenship that I don't know if you call it left or if you call it right. You know, there in the 60s, there were plenty on the left who talk this way. As it happens today, you know, there are some on the right who are talking this way. And I don't particularly want to put a label on it. To me, I just think that, you know, there are two great dangers to citizenship and two things that really crowd out strong citizenship. One, which we've been talking a bit about, is when government itself becomes so robust and occupies so much space in civic life that people assume it's not their problem. It's the problem of some other entity called government. The other, of course, force that you and I would agree upon is the market. The market surely crowds out civic identity and treats us all like consumers and makes us think of ourselves, even in relation to government, as just customers, either cranky or satisfied customers. And we aren't just customers. We are producers. Right. We are creators of civic life in a community. And that may not show up on the balance sheet of the city of Seattle, the state of Washington, or the United States. But it will show up in the social capital and in the health of our communities. And if we as progressives don't start talking about how citizens have to be cultivating amongst ourselves a stronger stronger ethic of responsibility and a greater diffusion of the skills of how to make stuff happen in a neighborhood and how to stitch community together, then I don't care how much funding you put behind government, and I don't care what theory of government you use, it's not going to be enough, right? And this is a part that this is where I will agree with some of my friends from the right, that we can't just rely on government alone, even where we acknowledge that government needs to be better funded and that government should not be demonized.
Right. Well, I understand that, but you know, we certainly have places, communities, maybe some of the neighborhoods that you're familiar with, where there is far more citizenship at that local level than there is trust in government. Like somehow those two have to connect to each other. In order for people to be good citizens in the broader sense that you put it, and I think a lot of it is also thinking of, you know, breaking the mode of government that thinks of, okay, there's this set of people who get benefits from the government and then there's us who aren't,
right.
You know,
right.
And that's really hard to break. I was, you know, when I was involved in all the welfare reform battles in the 90s, I would sort of try to say, let's break this idea that there's a set of people called welfare recipients and a set of people who aren't.
That's right.
You know, it's a social insurance program. I'm probably unlikely to be on it, but you know, this, you know, everybody's just a different distance from being on it at a given moment.
Well, another way
that's
to put
a very
it,
hard concept to break.
Well, but this is important, actually. I think you're onto something quite significant here. The other direction to go, of course, is to expand the frame of who's on quote unquote welfare, right? And so, you know, the analyses that are coming out now, you know, done by folks, you know, our colleagues, former colleagues at New America or people at the Corporation for Enterprise Development, that, you know, these analyses of the incredible upside down asset budget, the way in which our hundreds of billions of dollars a year spent on tax expenditures and tax breaks are so disproportionately steered toward the affluent and the already wealthy, that we have this invisible tax expenditure policy in the United States that is literally geared toward making the comfortable more comfortable and the rich richer.
Right. But that's, of course, inseparable from the submerged state concept, because that's the very thing that we think we're not benefiting from.
We're
not thinking about the mortgage interest tax deduction as a huge benefit.
I am all for making that submerged state visible. And for a debate, you know, if we're going to have a debate around taxation, it can't be only a debate about the marginal income tax rates at the federal government. It has to be about this incredible invisible tax expenditure budget that is rigged to reward the already comfortable.
And then I think the hope from that, just to finish the point, it's not like you interrupted me, but you know, the point I wanted to make is really that, you know, in order to get people to be good citizens in that beyond their own community, beyond their own neighborhood sense, they do need to have a different way of thinking about government. And I think making people understand the things that they really are getting from government is part of that. And actually making government programs, you know, robust enough that they're not, you know, they're not just a goal over here. They're a very tangible system. And that is what one appreciates about, you know, the big entitlements. And there's more to life than big entitlements. I'm not, you know, I'm not saying that's the model either, but these are the things that make people do understand as being government, and that's part of it. And then, of course, the other part of seeing government and this is the, your book kind of ends on this, and maybe this becomes the third part of the trilogy because it was sort of brief. The other part of restoring that confidence that allows people to be good citizens is changing the political process.
Is changing the process, yes, the rules of the game.
Changing the political process. I mean, I think people, you know, people used to say in that sort of reinventing governments, Gear Not Row era, people would say, you know, people don't trust government because when they go to the DMV, it's a nightmare, and dealing with Social Security Administration is a nightmare. And you know what? We've actually fixed that to a very significant degree.
I agree.
Going to DMV is painless. Social Security Administration wins all kinds of awards for, in the customer side of things, not the citizen side of things. But as citizens, where we interact with government is with this political process. You know, we see the process by which health reform was passed. We see, elections that are dominated by super PACs, things like that. So I wonder, do you have more? You do that fairly briefly, and I'm wondering if you want to get more, if in the future you might dig more deeply into that political reform element of citizenship.
Yes, I'm so glad you brought that up, Mark, because I think that the ways in which the rules of the game of our political process are so currently rigged need to be highlighted more and more. And so in the Gardens of Democracy, we talk a fair amount about economic inequality and both its root causes and its consequences. But one thing that we only touch on a bit in this book, and I think this moment is going to amplify and continually make a political issue, is the way in which economic inequality begets political inequality, which then sets in motion this vicious circle, because it then begets more economic inequality, right? And the way in which voice has been concentrated as much as wealth in this country, is embodied by things like super PACs. But you can put the super PACs aside. I mean, just in everyday garden variety, so to speak, electoral politics, you still see it. You see it in, we just held here in Seattle last weekend this national conference that I help organize on strong citizenship called the Guiding Lights Weekend. And among our speakers was Larry Lessig. And we had this fascinating panel conversation between Larry Lessig, who's been out there, as I think championing a whole lot of deep campaign finance reform and talking about his book Republic Lost. But he was in conversation with a fellow named Mark Meckler. Mark Meckler, as you may know, was the co-founder of the Tea Party Patriots. He actually stepped down from the Tea Party Patriots a few weeks ago, in part because he felt like that movement had become co-opted by big money and by the Republican Party. And what Lessig and Meckler...
That didn't happen just last week.
But his stepping down did. And what Lessig and Meckler talked about, Lessig more from the left and Meckler obviously more from the right, was that if there's one thing that this moment calls for, it is agreement from across the political spectrum, whether you are an occupier or a Tea Partier or any point between, that right now the rules of the political game are rigged, and that wealth buys results, and that you can buy your members of Congress, you can buy policy preferences, and what is very challenging here, Mark, it goes back to another word you used about a few minutes ago, which I think is critical. It's the critical nexus, as you said, between citizenship and government, and that is trust, right? And somehow we've got to figure out a way right now. This is a hard dance, but we've got to figure out a way simultaneously to say, hey, the game is rigged. Our politics, by any definition, have become more corrupted, while at the same time telling people, but believe enough in yourself and in the possibility of rejuvenation and regeneration that you can restore trust in the system. What we don't want to have happen is awaken everybody to the full depths of the corruption, only to have them say, well, screw it, I check out, right?
And Go ahead. Well, that's why, for example, I think you want method. That's what, for example, I've been really skeptical of the idea of the constitutional amendment to deal with Citizens United, both for some legal reasons, but also because I think that's just as a message, it may get people fired up, but the message it sends is you're actually never going to fix this problem. until you amend the Constitution, which is never going to happen. So it's almost like a way of talking about it that deepens mistrust rather than building trust.
And powerlessness or hopelessness,
Now, I think what's interesting, I think some of what you've talked about, you almost have like a solution, I think, in the book, because if you're talking about economic inequality in the way that you do, which is as something that actually has, you know, a significant cost to the whole society. You know, my friend Brad DeLong, the economist, has a little badge on his blog now that says we are the 100%. In other words, you know, some of these policies are actually just really bad for everyone because they're bad for society as a whole. If you take that kind of approach, then the idea of entrenched political inequality that reinforces entrenched economic inequality becomes something that's not, it's partly an us versus them thing, but it's also something that you can talk about in a sense of an overall atrophying of our capacity as a society to adapt, in fact, to changing
economic circumstances. You are absolutely right, Mark. And I think one of the things to sort of come full circle, in this conversation, I think one of the necessary precursors. So when we started this conversation, we were talking about metaphors, and I was explaining why we talk gardens rather than machines. But another metaphor to use, or a way to think about this, is cosmologically, kind of the way we have these whole pictures of how the world and the universe work that shape what we accept in a lot of political economy. So, you know, one very specific example of this, which is something yielded by and feeds into all of this economic inequality, is trickle-down economics, right? We have still today, even after the crash and the Great Recession, it is still the dominant cosmology in most people's minds, this idea that rich people, rich business people in particular, are job creators, and that the economy should revolve around a tiny number of rich people, right? And that we should be taking care of that tiny number of rich people because they are the creators. It is from them that wealth and jobs and employment and prosperity spring. You know, the last few years have taken the shine off that theory, but nothing has quite yet displaced it. And I think it really underscores what you're saying there about, this 100% framing, which is it's not enough simply to become disenchanted with the patently false ways in which the promise of trickle-down economics was never delivered upon. It's now necessary for us to replace trickle-down. And in the gardens of democracy, you know, what we say is we have to have a different cosmology altogether. Instead of trickle-down economics, it's what we call middle-out economics, that the economy does not revolve around a tiny number of small of rich people. The economy revolves around a great and ever-growing number of middle-class people, and that the real job creators are not rich business people. The real job creators in any sustainable economy are middle-class customers, that it is demand coming from a middle class that fuels an economy beyond one turn around the loop. You know, with rich people getting more money through tax breaks and a capital gains tax, you know, there will be a one-time plopping of resources down as wealth does trickle down and they buy more yachts and stuff and employ more shipbuilders and such. But that's not sustainable. It's only when you take this worldview of a middle-out economy and a middle-out growth theory that you get to this place. And I think this is so important, Mark, because people are – these last few months have been so exciting because people, both from the left and the right, are getting detached from old orthodoxies. They're challenging the way we do things, and that's both the source of Occupy and some of the continued Tea Party anger and everything else, Americans Elect, which you mentioned. But one of the things that we've got to get to now is convert from anger to an alternative. And begin to name affirmatively things like middle-out economics as the way to see the world and see how the universe works. And until we do that, we're just stirring up a lot of discontent that has no channel or no outlet.
Right, absolutely. I mean, I think we have to think about a way of working beyond anger. I mean, we may move in, you know, I think anger burns out. I think we may move into a less angry period of politics. Well, then how do we actually take what actually drove people for the last 3-4 years, really maybe as long ago as 2006, and, you know, bring it back to the solutions when people are able to be in that mode. It's not just, you know, because it's very hard to get constructive, get something constructive out of pure anger. Well, I thought, you know, your co-author, Nick Hanauer, I think did one of the best pieces of responding to the trickle to the job creator theory and trickle down economics. I sent this to, you know, half a dozen people. Was a piece he wrote about basically saying, as somebody who's, you know, been a business, an investor and a business person himself, I think he was one of the earlier investors in Amazon. Correct me if I'm wrong about that. You know, basically saying, look, being a job creator was never my goal. That's not what people get into business for. If they do, if they're successful, they may create jobs, but that's not what they're setting out to do. What we need is actually demand, you know, we succeed because there's demand for our products.
Customers.
Services we're providing. And that's the way, I mean, really a way of recasting that debate that nobody had really done. I just thought that was just one of those pieces that makes you say, yeah, absolutely. And by somebody who has some, you know, at least as much authority as Mitt Romney to talk about it.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that is the, you know, there's no question my co-author Nick Hanauer in that piece, which he wrote for Bloomberg, dismantles the job creator myth. But you know, his argument proceeds not only from the idea that, hey, I happen to have standing as a rich guy, you know, who to dispute this. It emerges again from this understanding of the world as a complex adaptive system. Understand the economy, you know, as composed of feedback loops between demand and business people, and not in this mechanistic notion where if you pour money into rich people at the top, then somehow jobs plop out at the bottom like donuts, right?
And
you know, as we just wrap up here, Mark, I want to just leave you and your readers with, you know, a couple of simple precepts. One of the ways you're familiar with, having read The Gardens of Democracy, we try to boil down some of these ideas, which are complex, into some simple, in a way, almost timeless precepts. And I just want to share two in particular as food for thought and a way to kind of button up our conversation. You know, our whole discussion in the book about the economy and about the way in which middle-out growth rather than trickle-down growth is beneficial, and the ways in which inequality, you know, is not just unfair, but that it's ineffective and counterproductive and stupid for the entire country, for all 100% of us, boils down to a simple precept, which we said is this: we're all better off when we're all better off. And I think, you know, as tautological as it sounds, it actually speaks a profound truth about creating positive feedback loops, that there is no way to kind of cordon off one part of the country's suffering or one part of the country's privation from another part of the country's comfort, that we're all better off, and that middle-out economics certainly is geared toward making the middle class more prosperous. But guess what also happens? It will make the rich plenty richer, too, when you have middle-led, middle-out growth. The other precept that I just want to close with, Mark, is, you know, back to our great conversation about citizenship and how it intersects with government. And, you know, what we boil it down to is this: society becomes how you behave. And again, we have a notion across both left and right that, you know, whether you like big government or not, whether you are a fan of the market or not, there is this kind of notion that my individual acts are just one in a billion, and they get canceled out by other people's individual acts. And so I may as well be the most self-seeking, selfish, you know, short-term thinking kind of person I can be, because that's the kind of world it is. And when you understand things mechanistically, that can, I suppose, seem plausible. But when you understand things in the garden metaphor, ecosystemically, you realize that every single act, every single choice you make, every single predisposition toward trust, toward courtesy, toward civility, is not just one in a billion that gets canceled out. It's hugely contagious. And society does become how you behave, right? And and I think this notion as a way to re-empower citizens, first at the level of the spirit, then at the level of skills down the road, is something that I think progressives need to be talking a whole lot more about. And, you know, it's kind of boiled down by this Northwest billboard I saw not long ago. I think it might have been in Portland, not Seattle, but it captures kind of an ethic here. It was a billboard on the side of this very, very crowded highway that was all jammed up in terrible gridlock. And the billboard said to the cars stuck there, it said, "You aren't stuck in traffic, you are traffic." and I think that sums up, you know, our view here of the kind of the power and the responsibility that we have as citizens. And anyway, I sure have enjoyed this conversation, Mark.
That is very Portland. Yeah, I have too, Eric. I think this is terrific, and good luck with the book. Hopefully this will be a good prep for Charlie Rose and Brian Lamb and all the other
This has been totally interesting, and I've really enjoyed getting to kick these ideas around with you.
Good. It's nice to catch up with somebody in, you know, semi-public. So, okay, let's wrap this up, and thanks everyone for watching this.
Okay.
Okay. Bye-bye.